Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery. With the answer to the age-old question of what's for dinner with chef-prepared food-to-go favorites. Your food is our passion.
The playwright and screenwriter Zaid Ayers-Dorn was born into a family that was on the run. Actually, on the run. His parents are Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers. They were central figures in the radical left-wing militant group, the Weather Underground. And at the time their son was born in 1978, they were fugitives. Zaid Ayers-Dorn has written a memoir about his childhood, which was shaped by secrecy and danger and the unresolved story of his parents' political lives. The book is called Dangerous, Dirty, Violent, and Young, and Catherine Weller of Weller Bookworks told us it was one of the most fascinating books she's read this season.
This is a deeply felt, deeply researched, deeply considered book by a man who grew up completely immersed in social justice. As he said, in my family, we went to protests and demonstrations the way some families go tailgating. He talks a lot about that family bonding in different ways and the way that his parents' activities, blowing up banks and the Pentagon and all kinds of things, for instance, broke up family bonds as well as deepened them. And there's this really gripping couple of pages where Bill, his father, is describing an emigration raid that happened at the dock he was working at. And Bill thought that they were after him.
Bill walked away that day shaken, but gifted, he says, with a new level of insight, aware of a strange and unfamiliar reality. He had always assumed, with the self-centered paranoia of a federal fugitive, that he was the only outlaw hiding out on the docks, paid off the books, desperate not to be seen or recognized. But it turns out that half the men on his crew were invisible, even to him. They were all living on a different plane, off the grid, undocumented, underground.
There's this sense of isolation, of being underground, but also this sense of community with these people who believed so passionately in what they wanted to do in helping people of color in America. And Zaid, who wrote this book, really grapples with that. He knew what it meant to be underground, but he was also profoundly insecure because he suspected that there were things his parents loved more than he did, and it was a very loving but profoundly insecure way to grow up.
That's Zaid Ayers-Dorn reading from his memoir, Dangerous, Dirty, Violent, and Young. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's our annual summer book show today. We have with us our group of book experts. They're all booksellers who have a long list of books for your hours by the pool or beach or campfire. We have with us Catherine Weller, who you just heard, along with Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books and Anne Holman of the King's English Bookshop. And we began with the books they've been reading lately. Here's Anne.
We are selling a book by Greg Jackson. He's a professor at Utah Valley University, and I didn't know him before we started doing this. He has a podcast called History Doesn't Suck, and the book is called Been There, Done That, and it's just exactly what the title says. So, you know, we're looking at a time in history where we all feel like we're at the edge of a cliff and there's no coming back. And the book is stories about American history where everybody felt that way, and maybe even worse, and they did come back. And I was delightfully surprised. So we did this event with him down at the Lehigh Library, and he read from the book a little bit, but he hired these two enactors. I think they might have been a husband and wife, and they were dressed up as colonial people, and they were running a colonial printing press the whole time he was talking. So there's this room of 300 people. This printing press is going.
During the event?
During the event. And he's talking, and he's really good, right? I mean, he's a podcaster. Really lively. And it turns out they were printing the Declaration of Independence, with all of its mistakes, like the original one with the typos and the mistakes. And when the event was over, they gave everybody a copy. And it's beautiful.
How cool.
And so I'm reading this book and I'm thinking, okay, I'm so saddened by everything that's going on. I'm so bereft. Everything's terrible. I've got grandkids. What are they going to do? And then I thought, you know what? Let's just be a little bit hopeful. Let's just be a little bit hopeful.
Because we've been here before, and at least sort of.
And there are some really good stories
yeah.
that we have to look a little harder for, but they're there.
So you're getting perspective from that.
Trying to, yeah.
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 You, Kat?
Hot classic summer. This is the summer of the Odyssey, right? So people are really delving into the classics. The book is called Sparta, The Rise and Fall of an Ancient Superpower. It's by the historian Andrew Bayliss. And it is a deep, yeah, somewhat deep and very nuanced examination of Sparta. And I want to put it in the hands of every young man who is, we are Sparta, and, you know, it's embracing this warrior culture so yeah. that they get more of an understanding of what made that warrior culture and the ramifications of that warrior culture. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, some cute little factoids in there. For all of the warrior cultures and enslaving cultures of that time, and they were in Greece, the Spartans were the most democratic of them all, which is mind-blowing. Women could own property. And slaveholding was democratic throughout the structure of the Spartans, which is not to say it's a manifestation of democracy, but every Spartan citizen had the ability to enslave people, and they did. And it allowed them to become this fearsome war machine because all they had to do was think about keeping their bodies toned. But there are costs to all of that. And hubris, the story, the theme of all of these stories, right? Hubris is a big part of this, and it's real. So it's nice to tie into real history instead of picking and choosing these icons and turning them into what we want them to be.
Wow. Ken, what are you reading?
Well, Doug, my old friend Luis Urrea is a new novel of World War II that has nothing to do with these times we live in, but sometimes you need an escape from what's going on around us. He has a lot of really interesting relatives. This one is a great aunt who served in what was called the Donut Brigade in World War II as a waver, a whacker, whatever. And it's a story of his own great aunt, but also it poses as a novel, but it's a nonfiction story of these women that actually found themselves on the front lines of World War II and in some of the major battles, and they were called and they resisted it and hated it, and they suffer the horrors of war like you've never seen, just like the men. They get bombed, they get injured, they're running from live munitions. I haven't finished it yet, and I can't wait to finish it.
So two of you are into history. Ken, you're looking for escape.
But great, it's history.
But it's history, yes. Mm-hmm. And it's nonfiction. And that,
but it's he writes it in the form of a novel.
Yeah.
But it's based on true stories.
Okay. All right. Well, speaking of nonfiction, let's jump in. That's our first section. Catherine, you go first.
Okay. I have a book that I am coming to late, and I thought about Ken the whole way through it. It's called The Key to Everything, Mae Swenson, A Writer's Life. And it is an extraordinary biography of one of the greatest American poets probably ever, and certainly of the 20th century.
Amen.
And she was a person born in Logan, raised in Cache County, moved to New York to live her life honestly, and that means as a queer woman, as an artist, in some ways as an iconoclast, and as a person who valued her interiority and the ability to express it on the page. The thing that's remarkable about this biography is most of it is taken from her writing. The author allows her to tell her own story within this book, and it is beautiful. I will say I have turned into an evangelist like Ken is, because I think Mae Swenson is a writer for the moment.
Wow.
Queer woman, living authentically, breaking boundaries, starting new forms of writing, new ways of living, being herself. Key to Everything, Mae Swenson, A Writer's Life, and it's by Margaret A. Brusha. My next one is Salt Lakes and Natural History by Caroline Tracy. I talked this up quite a bit at the beginning of the year. This is about inland salt lakes around the world, not just ours, though it begins with our salt lake. It begins with a protest to save our lake. It is also a journey through self, while it is a journey through Salt Lake. So it's exploring the very unique biospheres within Salt Lakes. And Caroline is also examining her sphere.
It's deeply and she, personal, isn't it?
Yeah, it's deeply personal. And she comes out as a queer woman in her explorations of lakes and writes about that in the book and eventually ends up writing about salt lakes of all kinds, and we're talking from California all the way over into Turkey, as queer spaces, because they are unusual. They're their own things. They've evolved in their own ways. It's lovely writing, just lovely. Salt Lakes and a Natural History by Caroline Tracy. My last one is called By the Hills, A Home in the Himalaya by Anuradha Roy. Roy is the lesser known Roy of the female Indian writers, but she is a writer in her own right. She's written several highly regarded novels and essays. This is her first piece of book-length nonfiction, and it's about when she decides to leave the city and go into a village in the foothills of the Himalayas, and her work towards creating home there, learning about it as a place on its own terms, in its own ways. It's beautiful. It's poetic. It's not overly romantic in its description of the land, the people, or their treatment of animals, but it is affectionate, and it is deep and moving. I don't often think of nonfiction in the sense of cozy, like we have cozy fantasy, et cetera, et cetera. But despite the unstinting, unvarnished portrayals of things, it is a cozy piece of fiction. That building of home and delving into space, it's life-renewing, it's life-affirming. Hmm. So, Called by the Hills, A Home in the Himalaya by Anuradha Roy.
Great. Ken Sanders.
Well, Doug, I came from a middle-class background, South Salt Lake. I certainly never missed a meal in my life, went hungry. But I've had a lifelong fascination with hobos and vagabonds and tramps. But I've never lived the life. So Robert Suits, The Hobo, A History of America's First Climate Migrants. That really intrigued me. And you think about it, they followed timber seasonally. They followed mining. And especially even to this day, except for our crackdown on immigrants, the harvest crops. And this book does a really, really good job of articulating the whole history of hobos and climate change. It's a fascinating read.
It's called The Hobo.
The Hobo, Robert Suits. Michael Pollan, as we all know, he got his start writing a simple little book about building a house. And then every book he did after that just gets more interesting, more complex, more scientific. This new one, oh boy, it's really, really dense. Man.
It's about consciousness, we should say.
A world appears, a journey into consciousness. Yeah. Well, what does he mean by that? I picked out just a small paragraph, and this not too dense. A World Appears explores a handful of leading theories of consciousness, but by no means all of the 24 or so theories that I have been proposed in the last few years. I've focused on the ones I found most helpful in illuminating the phenomena of sentience, feeling, thought, and selfhood. I cannot guarantee by the end of this book you will know more about consciousness than you do now. Like me, you may find that you know less than you do now. You may discover that, as it turns out, things you thought we solidly knew about consciousness, such as the presumption that it is generated by brains, that it gives us a faithful picture of reality, we really don't know at all. Michael Pollan, A World Appears, A Journey into Consciousness. Lastly, and I can't take too much time with this, I have known Terry Tempest Williams since her days up here at the U at the Museum of Natural History, and then when she first came to fame with perhaps her most endearing book, Refuge, An Unnatural History of Place. The new one, The Glorians, Visitations from the Holy Ordinary by Terry Tempest Williams. When I got my review copy last year, and we had her for a big signing and event, I said, Terry, what on earth is a Glorian? And Terry replied, Ken, is it okay if I tell you I don't know? That's Terry. I want to read one quick, because I really believe in letting the authors talk. I believe Earth is dreaming us into a new way of seeing, a new way of being, if we will favor our senses and receive what is coming to us through heartbreak and love. Joy, pain, and prayer make me to know your ways, instructs Psalm 25:4. Whose ways? My God is not singular, not gendered, not human in form, because the gods I recognize are many, multitudinous, mysterious, and infinite. They are everywhere and commonplace, with mouths and eyes and arms and legs, with wings and hooves and fins and furs, with gills and trunks and leaves and spores, and, in the case of the horned lizard, with eyes that can squirt blood as a carnal warning. Be aware of us and wary. The Glorians, Terry Tempest Williams.
Wow. Okay. All right, Anne, how are you feeling? Anne Holman.
I know, all of these are all so good. Well, okay, I'm going to start out with Planet Money, A Guide to the Economic Forces That Shape Your Life by Alex Mayasi. He is, as you know, the podcast Planet Money, because if you're going to come for me with math, you better do it with a funny story. It's the only way I'm going to understand it. And this book is full of the stories that they've told, kind of about things that have happened over time that have brought our economy and our world to where they are today.
Yeah.
There's a story in there about Desi Arnaz, which I didn't know. He was born in Cuba to a really wealthy family. His father was one of the primary executives at Bacardi. And then it goes on to tell the story of how he met Lucy, how the Squamish Nation in Canada is creating housing for everybody by going up. We're so anathema to going up, but maybe that's the way to do it. There's graphs, there's funny stories, there's pictures. There's a graph in there about inflation and the tooth fairy, which is the only way I'm going to understand it, right? I mean, we got a quarter if we were lucky, right? Now it's maybe 10 bucks. Anyway, And how money works and how people can be fair with it. There's a whole story in here about the New York City Marathon and how they do it as a lottery. And so you don't have to be the fastest runner to get in. It's just fair. I love the idea of it being fair.
So it's not just about money principles.
Money.
It's about storytelling.
Yeah.
To make it make sense.
Yeah. Which is, I think, how you have to do it with an English major. Bruce Feiler is a New York Times bestselling author. He's written just a ton of nonfiction books about all different kinds of things. But his new book is called The Time to Gather, How Ritual Created the World and How It Can Save Us. He's Jewish, and so he has a Jewish perspective about ritual. But in this time and age, for me, ritual seems like a way that you can recreate your community and you can be in love with your world in ways that we've come away from. We don't need to be alone in our homes. We can go out and we can go to church. We can go on a hike. We can go pet somebody's dog. You can volunteer at Best Friends, but have something that you do every week. I mean, for me, it's obviously picking up a book. It's playing with my grandkids, but there are so many things. And this is kind of a guidebook as to how to do it. So it's A Time to Gather, How Ritual Created the World and How It Can Save Us. Bruce Feiler, I love him. But I really want to spend time on The Book of Birds, A Field Guide to Wonder and Loss by Robert McFarlane and Jackie Morris. So they started this project, 10 or 15 years ago. And the first book was The Lost Words. It was a giant picture book of birds. And the Oxford English Dictionary had decided in all its wisdom that children weren't really using a lot of these words anymore, so they were just going to take them out of the dictionary. Words like wren and hatch and putting them, and then they were putting words in like Sims. It was ridiculous. And so they did this book, and then a few years later came a little book called The Lost Spells, again, beautifully illustrated poetry. But this book, The Book of Birds, is the culmination of their work. It's filled with 49 different birds that are endangered in Great Britain, paintings, and if you know anything about Rob McFarlane, you know that he's just a prose poet Everything he writes, everything he says.
And so prolific.
And so prolific. I mean, it's unbelievable. And so this book is divided into seven sections. And he said it happened by accident, but it's seven sections. And then there's seven birds within each seven sections. And so you begin with the nest, and then the seven birds. And then there's the egg, and the seven birds. Beak, song, feather, flight, and then finally migration. And on the first page of each bird, there's a painting by Jackie, and then he does a little paragraph that is literally a prose poem about that bird. And you just open it up, and you fall into it. We did an event with Robert, and it was just a fluke that we got him, but we did it at the aviary. And it was on the lawn when the birds were doing what they do, and it was Robert McFarlane and Tim Brown, who's the CEO of the aviary, in this great conversation. And I feel like the audience, I know I was transported. Rob says he's not a birder, but I don't know how he could say that. I mean, it's just everything.
He's an observer.
Yeah.
Of the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
Say the name again.
It's The Book of Birds, A Field Guide to Wonder and Loss by Robert McFarlane and Jackie Morris.
That's Ann Holman. She's co-owner of the King's English Bookshop on 15th and 15th in Salt Lake. We also have with us Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books. They're on the in the old library building of Library Square in Salt Lake City. Catherine Weller is with us with Weller Bookworks in Trolley Square. We have a list of all of these titles and the ones we inevitably won't get to on our website, RadioWest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery. With the answer to the age-old question of what's for dinner with chef-prepared food-to-go favorites. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's our summer book show today. We have with us our book experts here to help you pick your beach read or pool read or wherever you're reading this vacation season. We have with us Catherine Weller of Weller Bookworks, Ann Holman of the King's English Bookshop, and Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books. And like a lot of us lately, Ken has been thinking about the lake.
Here in Utah, we have two huge bodies of water, the Colorado River and the Great Salt Lake. From the 1980s, when the Colorado River was running almost 100,000 cubic feet per second, and the Great Salt Lake was pushing driftwood, as it were, up onto the Interstate 80 freeway, we have been in a perpetual drought ever since then. Fast forward all these decades, we're in could be losing both of our great bodies of water. And that brings me to this new book, edited by Michael McLean, The Once and Future Lake, Stories for Great Salt Lake. What he has done is compile an anthology of all the great writing about the Great Salt Lake, going back to Howard Stansberry, the first explorer, to Jim Bridger, the first mountain man to see it, the indigenous peoples and their views in the lake, and goes through all of the literature from ancient to modern. Here's from McLean's introduction. Salt Lake City and much of Utah was born of a people who believed themselves exceptional, who wandered far into the wilderness in Exodus, and whose myths tell of making the desert bloom. But we know how these water stories end. We can only be exceptional in our capacity for both empathy and change. Our myths cannot save us this time. The only persecution here we have brought upon ourselves. We have a brief window to shift this trajectory, and it is imperative we are honest about the equality of sacrifice and changes necessary to achieve it. Of course, we all know of the Great Salt Lake. And only by spending enormous amounts of time out there can you possibly even begin to comprehend it. I'm not saying I know the Great Salt Lake or the Salt Flats or the Basin and Range and the mountains and the salt, but you develop awareness of it. You can walk out there and see the curvature of the earth. You can walk out there and see a segment of the Donner Party's wagon ruts in old dried mud that still exist. Time stops out there. That lake, even though it's dying, it's alive, it's feral, it holds hidden treasures. And the more time you spend out there, the more you'll get to maybe understand it a little bit.
Ken Sanders, talking about the Once and Future Lake, Stories for Great Salt Lake. It's edited by Michael McLean. Okay, on to round two. And on to fiction. Anne, you go first.
Okay. I'm going to start with How to Commit a Post-Colonial Murder by Nina McConaughey. She wrote a collection of short stories a couple years ago called Cowboys and East Indians. She grew up in Wyoming. It's a funny story, though. Her mother is Indian. Her father is Irish. They met in college, and he was working in Singapore and got transferred to Wyoming. And she tells the story that her mother moved and didn't unpack the boxes for 3 years. So they're living in, it was either Casper or Laramie, I don't remember. Anyway, fast forward 20 or 30 years, her mother's a state senator for Wyoming. This is a story of two sisters, little sisters, growing up in a family in Wyoming, and their aunt and uncle come to live with them. The aunt, I think, is the mother's sister. And the uncle is extremely inappropriate. Without going into too much detail, the two sisters decide he needs to die. How are they going to do that? They're not even really that old. The book goes along. They live their lives. You learn a lot about being Indian in Wyoming and how they don't even have good Indian food there. They have to go to another state. But lo and behold, the uncle dies. Who murdered him? They're not really sure. We're not really sure. I love this story because it's about the West. It's about being different in the West. I think Nina McConaughey is super talented. She's a professor at Colorado State now, and I think we'll see a lot more of her. So this is How to Commit a Post-Colonial Murder by Nina McConaughey.
Great.
I have to mention Ali Condie because this is her second mystery. She wrote The Unwedding. It was a ton of fun. The girl's trip takes place mostly in Zion, and she renames everything. So if you're not from here, you wouldn't know. But if you're from Utah, you know that it's Angel's Landing. You know it's the Narrows. It's Zion National Park. And these three women become really good friends online during the pandemic in a book club and start meeting afterwards online and really kind of continue the relationship. And it's not very long before two of them realize that the one woman is an extremely, extremely famous actress. And that's okay. They love her. And they decide to take a trip. And the actress says, this is where I want to go. They get down there. They start hiking. They decide to put their phones away so nobody will know where they are. Bad idea. As it turns out, there's a murder. And somebody else has been in that chat room back in the day that they didn't know about. And so the other thing that happens, because of course it has to happen, is the Narrows floods. Who gets out and who doesn't get out, and then what happens from there. It's great fun. I think Ellie's a really fun writer.
Anne, you said that up really well. Mm-hmm. Say the name again.
Oh, good. It's The Girl's Trip by Ali Condie. She writes a lot of great YA, but boy, her mysteries are fun. Okay, I don't fancy myself a horror reader per se, and I feel like when I do read horror, it's often the scariest thing ever. Victorian Psycho. Have either of you read this?
Yeah.
Isn't it the most fun you've ever seen?
It's really fun.
Okay, so this is Virginia Fito. It's about a woman in Victorian London, England somewhere. She becomes a nanny for a very well-off family. The mother's awful. The father's a lech. And the two kids are obviously crazy. But there's nobody crazier than the nanny. And she, the thing that I love about this nanny is she's very impatient. And so when somebody's not looking, if she doesn't like them, she just stabs them and throws them under the bed. Or she walks outside one night and there are all these bodies hanging in the trees that she's hung there, but you don't even know when she did it. And it seems to happen as if nobody's really paying attention. And then when they finally do pay attention, the little girl becomes her aide-de-camp. And nobody gets off scot-free, including the nanny. And the movie's coming. I don't know if I'm going to love the movie as much as the book, but sometimes there's nothing like a good horror novel to get you out of your comfort zone. Anyway, that's Victorian Psycho by Virginia Fido.
Great. All right, Mr. Sanders.
Okay, The Hill. Harriet Clark, she's a first-time novelist. She wrote a short story that the Paris Review gave her the Plimpton Prize for, fellowship from the Iowa Writers Workshop and the Wallace Stegner Program.
Wow.
Pretty impressive, I think.
Yeah.
She's in the novel, the little girl, she's a baby, when her mom and her friends decide early one morning to rob a bank with a bunch of fellow radicals. So she, her whole life is spent visiting her mother in prison, being raised by her grandmother, except grandma won't forgive her daughter for robbing the damn bank, even though she still belongs to a communist group. So it's a very it's not a normal childhood at all.
Okay.
And the whole tension is about how this girl grows up to an adult with all the tension in her life, and she vows that she will visit her mother in prison forever. The Hill by Harriet Clark. Tayari Jones, this is her fourth or fifth book. Her earlier novel.
Say the name of the title.
Kin. I almost said my name. Kin by Tayari Jones. This novel is about two young women being raised without mothers, and they're best friends throughout their entire life, but their lives take radically different paths. They're both black women. For me, it's a really interesting dive into two lives that I don't have any personal knowledge or history of. So it's always fascinating to learn how other people deal with things.
Yeah.
Lastly, Land, a novel by Maggie O'Farrell. Mm. This is a novel that takes place after the Great Famine in Ireland, like right before.
We should say, and this is the writer of Hamnet.
Hamnet, yes. Best-selling author of Hamnet.
Yes.
She's very well-known, Irish woman. But this is a novel set before, during, and after the Great Famine in Ireland. And the British are coming, and the Irish are supposed to be doing this great mapping of the entire country. And the end sheets that no one can see are the map. And somehow, because his father goes off the rails, the 10-year-old boy has to finish, and they don't, the British are coming. And sorry about that. And the 10-year-old boy is supposed to finish this great mapping ordinance. And how on earth is he going to get that done? It's called Land, a novel by Maggie O'Farrell, author of Hamnet.
Yes, indeed. Thank you. All right, Kat.
Okay, I'm returning to Hot Classic Summer. I'm starting with Son of Nobody, which is the latest novel from Jan Martel, author of Life of Pi. This book, like a lot of reconsiderations of Greek classics, seems very fresh because it's retelling a story. The lens he's using to retell it is slightly different, in that this is the tale of a lost manuscript that is discovered and is held by the Oxford Library of a person who fought in the Battle of Troy. But he's not one of the great heroes. He's one of the foot soldiers. He's a nobody. He is not named. He's not worthy of a name. So the translator, who lives in the North American continent, he lives in Canada, takes a fellowship over to Oxford to translate this. He names the person Soaz. Our translator is leaving a failing marriage, a delightful child, a crumbling career, and going off to do this thing that is his drive. And so the two things that are similar and different are this book is written in the format of an academic journal or piece of writing, like something you would produce after a fellowship, in that the top of the page is his translation of the text. The bottom of the page is footnotes about his translations. Only what's happening is he's not just explaining the life of the person he calls Soaz. He's explaining his life and his decisions to his child, whom he has left behind in Canada. The layout has been, that kind of layout's been done before, most notably by Nabokov back in the day. And the retelling through a different lens. Of course, we've all seen it through a feminist lens. This is through a lens of class. And it is delightful. If everything I said makes you think this is stodgy, it's not, even though it's footnoted to beyond and back, because Jan Martel is such a wonderful, wonderful writer. Anybody who's read Life of Pi knows what a wonderful writer he is.
Son of nobody.
Son of nobody. Next one. This is also an Oprah pick. I'm going to say some Oprah books are really good, and this is one of them. John of John by Douglas Stewart. He wrote Shuggy Bane. This book is extraordinary. Mm-hmm. It is set on a very small, very rural, very closed island in Scotland. A young art student returns from Edinburgh to get his feet under himself. He can't support himself as an artist. He goes back to live with his father and his grandmother. He works in the mill. He's in this town that is so Calvinist. They lock up the swings on a Saturday night so kids don't play on Sunday. And he's gay. And he's loving a land and a people and sometimes a way of life that cannot and will not ever love him back. And yet, there's an ending to this that is transformative. All the way through, you're looking at this and thinking, oh, no, don't do that, don't do that, don't do that. And then all of a sudden, there's this ending. And it is such a moment of grace. It is gorgeous. It's just heartrending. John of John by Douglas Stewart. Very quickly, The Animal Room by Lauren M. Acampora. This is about the human-wildland interface, only really it's about how humans become wild in a Connecticut suburb. The wilderness is never very far away. It's really inside of us.
That's great. It's Catherine Weller of Weller Bookworks, along with Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books, and Anne Holman. She's the co-owner of the King's English Bookshop. We have all of these books, the list of them, on our website because we won't get to all of them, but you can go check it out at radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from our members. Find out how at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Anne Patchett has a new novel. She said it was inspired by her grief over the loss of a close friend and that she began to imagine what that bond might have looked like if the timing had been different. The book is an exploration of memory and absence and the way brief encounters can shape a life. It's called Whistler. And it's on Anne Holman's summer book list.
The main character is Daphne, who's in her 50s now and happily married. And she and her husband are at an art museum looking at the exhibits. And they realize that somebody's kind of following them. They discover that it's Eddie Triplett, Daphne's stepfather of 40 years ago. She loved him dearly, and she'd never seen him again since. So Eddie comes to pick Daphne up from school because her sister Lita has fallen ill and actually has ended up in the hospital with appendicitis. And so they decide to take a car ride and look at the stars.
Both of them were looking up, trying to take in the wonder of the universe, when the car, going forward, left the edge of the road and pitched into the fathomless darkness below. There was no time to correct the situation, but a seemingly infinite amount of time to consider it. What Eddie wanted to know and did not know was if Daphne was wearing her seatbelt. He knew he hadn't put it on her himself. She was 9, she put her own seatbelt on, but it was his responsibility to check, and he had not checked. He would not be forgiven, not by Abigail or himself or the God of all those stars. impact arrived when he reached the word stars in his mind, and the car tossed like a boat on high seas before coming to rest on its left side. Eddie's head rested on the driver's side window, and he felt something catastrophic in the area of his left foot or ankle. He turned to look over his right shoulder, and in the utter darkness, he could make out the shape of something dangling. He did not know if she was dead or alive, but she had put her seatbelt on.
What happens is, while they're in the car waiting to be rescued, he tells her the story of this woman who owned a horse named Whistler. And he finally has to send Daphne out of the car to get help, and she does. But her mother is so furious that she basically casts him out, and he never sees her again. But it's how they reconnect at the museum, and they decide once and forever that they're never going to let this relationship go astray again, and they become fast friends. And then you meet the people that she might have known when she was 9, but now she's 57, and so everything she thought she knew then isn't what it was. And it's just this whole love story, and it's how love reflects among different kinds of people in different ways. But the love that Eddie has for his stepdaughter, Daphne, is one of the most special things I've ever read.
That's Ann Patchett reading from her new novel, Whistler. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Let's get back to our book experts and more ideas for your summer reading. All right, we're on to children's books, and we'll start with Ken Sanders.
Doug, as you know, I have a 14-year-old granddaughter, Lyra, lives out in California. So far this year, 2026, she has read 150 books. So I've become slightly more aware of young adult literature, though she reads adult stuff too.
Yeah.
So I've picked three YA titles for today. A first-time novel by a Chicana writer, Renee Peña Govia, Estrella Undrowning. This is a novel about a young woman, a high schooler. She's a genius in high school, but she likes to keep her head down. She doesn't want to attract attention. Mm. It gets into all kinds of identity fights and stuff that teenagers, they go through a lot when we're that age. And this is her story and how she comes out of it. And it's a really well-written book that really gets into the lives of a young Chicana woman or about-to-be woman. First-time novelist, Estrella Undrowning, Renee Peña Govia. Another first-time novelist, Their Will Undone by R.J. Valdepatas.
Wow.
Now, this woman, you talk about ethnicity. She's a Peruvian Venezuelan living in Florida. And as she I assume she had to have written this, where she lives with her husband, 5 children, 3 goats, and 9 chickens. No PR writer wrote that. She wrote that.
Gotcha.
I'm pretty sure. So this is really offbeat. It's called Their Will Undone. Mm. So in this woman's culture, somebody kind of like Shirley Jackson's The Lottery, Nina's brother's been chosen for the harvest, and they got their eyes set on her sister. So she sacrifices herself for the gods. So she's taken to a gilded cage where women train to become the servants and slaves, right? Except she learns her fate. The emperor has chosen her to be his bride. And this is how she gets out of it.
Wow.
I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Ken, thanks. Catherine, over to you.
Who among us has not wondered what happens when you put your baggage on the baggage conveyor?
Or, where does it go?
Yeah, exactly. Where does it go? Who among us has not? This book, Behind the Scenes, Airports, which is illustrated by Maxime Usyk, will tell you that, where your baggage goes and how it's tracked and how it gets hopefully, where it's supposed to be. It will also tell you if you can take snakes on a plane or what the security screener sees when they scan your body, the names of all of the vehicles that are out on the airport runway. It is so fun. Oh, my God, I love this book.
People listening know kids who will absolutely love this book, right?
Oh, yeah.
People listening will love this book.
Yeah.
Behind the Scenes Airports by Maxime Usyk.
Okay.
Next is Searching for Wox. This kid, you mentioned Desi Arnaz. I'll mention Lucille Ball in the Long, Long Trailer, where she just kept putting rocks in the trailer. This kid loves wox, and I loved wox when I was a kid, too. And this kid collects wox wherever he goes. Wherever they go. They keep them. They find power in them. They love them. They take them home and bring them out and keep them in their wok collection. It is Searching for Woks. This is a wonderful read aloud for younger kids. Poetry. Goldfinches by Mary Oliver. This is the poem that has been illustrated by a Caldecott honoree, Melissa Sweet. And it is just page after page of lovely collage that illustrates Mary Oliver's ode to spring, ode to nature called Goldfinches. And finally, Unicorns in Uniforms. This, again, is a picture book. It's by Beth Ferry and A.N. Kang. And there is a village in a forest that has unicorns who are hoofed and horned and well-informed and ready to help you. As they say, there are ballet teachers, there are scientists, there are mail carriers, and they're going to battle some dragon storms, too. These unicorns cannot be stopped. They are Unicorns in Uniforms. It's by Beth Ferry and A.N. Kang.
That's great. Ann Holman.
Well, in honor of the World Cup, Leo Espinoza is a local artist and illustrator. He's done a lot of work for The New Yorker, and originally from Colombia, but he lives here now. And he loved playing soccer when he was little in Colombia. His father was his coach, and he loved him very much. But his papa had a red mustache, and all of the other papas had black mustaches. Mm-hmm. And so this is the story of a papa and his daughter who go to a soccer game, and she's very excited to go. She loves soccer, but all of the papas, everybody has a black mustache. Well, as you find out, she gets lost at the soccer match, and it's a very big field, and everybody has a black mustache. And when her father realizes that she's gone, he's so afraid. But then she gets rescued because she can see his red mustache across the field. So, Leo Espinoza, I love his books. They're so much fun.
And it's My Papa Has.
My Papa Has a Red Mustache. Marcy K. Monson is also a local author. She works at Gibbs Smith, and this is her third in a mini mystery series, The Secret of the Old Clock. And so what she does is the first Nancy Drew, you'll remember, The Secret of the Old Clock. But she takes them and makes them available to younger readers. And so it's the actual characters. Interesting fact here, she had to go back to the original Nancy Drews, which are now in the public domain. And so we didn't have Bess or Ned or any of those people yet. So a lot of these people I didn't even know. But she takes the story and she makes it accessible to middle readers and even a little bit younger. And there's always a map and some activities and things to do on the page. And just a wonderful way of introducing kids to something that they can look forward to in the future.
Did she keep the 1930s clothing?
She did. And in fact, so Gibbs Smith is distributed by Simon & Schuster now.
Oh. Yeah.
And they bought the rights to Nancy Drew.
Oh.
So she's got a long life ahead of her.
She sure does.
And she's terrific. She's really fun and really funny. So it's The Secret of the Old Clock, a Nancy Drew detective story by Marcy K. Monson. This is one I'm really proud of because Alexis Powell is one of our booksellers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's coming out in July, a couple weeks from now. It's A Coven of Witches by Alexis Powell. It glows in the dark. And
It actually glows in the dark. Wow.
Yep. And so they're tales. It's fiction about witches, but each tale is based on a real witch mythology or a real witch. In fact, the first one starts with, the Chicken House, which is one of my favorites.
And then each story has a fright level. So if you're reading to a little tiny one and they don't need too much, you can skip that one. And then at the end of every story, she talks about where it comes from, the mythology and the fairy tale or what have you. There's one in here about Circe, so that's perfect for the summer and the Odyssey. Mm-hmm. But it's filled with these beautiful illustrations of these witches. I mean, there's a story about Mayday, not too scary. But then there's a story about Circe, and she was pretty rad, right? So it's A Coven of Witches by Alexis Powell, one of our booksellers.
Wow. It's Anne Holman, co-owner of the King's English Bookshop on 15th and 15th in Salt Lake. We had with us also, of course, Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books. They're in the old library building on Library Square in Salt Lake. And Kat Weller, she is with Weller Bookworks in Trolley Square. Thanks, everyone.
We did it.
You did it, absolutely. We have a list of all of these titles and the ones we didn't get to on our website, of course, radiowest.org, because we didn't get to all of them. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can find the show, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on Instagram at Radio West. We're on YouTube at KUER90.1. You can email us at KUER.org, radiowest@KUER.org. Our intern is Aidan Oneida, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.